Everyone in Zoom and Facebook land to our second Ask an Expert COVID-19 panel discussion. We're glad that you could be with us tonight. I'm Jen Robinson. I am the chair of the Safety and Health Committee for City Council. And while I can't see you, I'm going to imagine that there's a large audience of people with some really great questions for our panelists tonight. I know they're ready for it. So without further ado, let me introduce our panelists to you and we'll get right to it. First, I'd like to introduce Joe Mazzola. Joe, if you could wave so everyone can see who you are. Joe was appointed on January 10th, 2017 as Health Commissioner, and he oversees the day-to-day operations and is responsible for strategic initiatives of Franklin County Public Health. Previously, he served as Director of Health Services and Planning at Franklin County Public Health. And in addition to being Franklin County's Health Commissioner, Joe serves as President-elect for the Association of Ohio Health Commissioners. He's also served as an at-large member of the Governing Council of Ohio Public Health Association. And he has a master's degree in public administration with a concentration in public health from Kent State University. I was going to say Zips, but I think that's Akron, so I'm going to not say anything. How's that? And a Bachelor of Arts degree in marketing from Marietta. So Joe, thank you so much for being with us tonight. Second, we're welcoming back to the panel Dr. Abigail Norris Turner. Dr. Turner has conducted domestic and international research for nearly 20 years, and her research characterizes the behavioral, clinical, and immunological factors associated with increased risk of disease acquisition. Lots of big 50-cent words in that one, Abby. Thank you so much for being here tonight. New to our panel tonight also is Dr. Roger Freeman, who not only is my neighbor, but he is a graduate of Miami University and the Ohio State University School of Medicine. He's been in practice in Columbus since 1982. He has been a clinical professor at Nationwide Children's Hospital in the Allergy and Immunology Department, and he is currently in practice with Ohio ENT and Allergy Physicians. He's a past president of Nationwide Children's Hospital medical staff and is the chairman of Nationwide Children's Hospital and the Ohio State University College of Medicine's alumni associations. You've lived in Bexley for 36 years, so I think you win the prize of all of the panelists. And my favorite part of your bio is that you have 4.5 grandkids. I'm assuming that one is on the way. Congratulations, that's really exciting. Also, welcome back to the panel, Beth Weinstock, MD. Dr. Weinstock is a physician at Equitas Health, formerly the Columbus AIDS Task Force and AIDS Resource Center of Ohio, serving all primary care needs, but mostly the LGBTQ+ population, HIV positive population, and hepatitis C infected individuals. Beth, welcome back to the panel. I look forward to hearing from you. And finally, welcome back as a panelist and moderator this evening, Dr. Michael Weinstock, MD. Michael is an emergency medicine physician, teacher, physician, and researcher. He's also the author of the Bounce Back series of books and has lectured nationally and internationally on topics of patient safety, evaluation of ED chest pain, and documentation. Panelists, thank you for being here tonight. Oh, and I completely overlooked and should not have our esteemed mayor, Mayor Ben Kessler, joining us from a cabin way out yonder. So if there's some sketchy Wi-Fi connection, he'll be on top of getting himself reconnected. But thank you guys all for being here tonight, and thank you for making time to answer some questions. The last 5 months have certainly been crazy. We've learned a lot, and then we've also learned that we don't know a whole lot still. So I'm going to hand it over to Michael now and let you take over and get us going. Thanks so much.
Well, Jen, thanks so much, and Ben also for getting all this thing organized. And you know, it's funny, we sort of moved through those stages of grief in some ways as a country, as a community, in the sense that we first probably were in denial, and then we had some sort of acceptance, and now we're a little bit like in the bargaining stage. We're sort of trying to figure out how, you know, it works within here. Some things aren't that bad. We can go to the park with the dog. We can, you know, maybe sit outside at a restaurant. But on the other hand, we are still very reluctant to, maybe fly on an airplane or visit the grandparents or take the kids to the grandparents, that kind of thing. So it's a really difficult time, especially now that we know that this is going to go on for quite a while. And even some stuff that came out today is that, you know, a vaccine, it's not going to be like you can give 380 million people or however many people live in America or even the world the vaccine, and maybe there's a second dose that's needed, and then all of a sudden everything will be back to normal. So some of the stuff that we have, the social distancing, the masks, et cetera, maybe even more than that, are going to be left with us for a while. What I wanted to do is start actually with Abby and with your background as an epidemiologist and your expertise, I should say, as an epidemiologist at Ohio State. I want to sort of direct just a couple of specific questions to you. The first is the thought that as far as mask wearing, one estimation was we really need 85 to 90% of people to be wearing masks. And even as Dr. Birx had mentioned in the last several days, possibly even wearing a mask indoors at home if there's someone that's at risk. And so I'm wondering is, what do you see us moving towards as far as we're going on the long haul, long stretch with this? And then the second thing is, how are we sort of balancing some of the safety issues that we want, again, with at higher risk people, with some of our own sort of maybe their needs, maybe their wants, but going out to dinner and going to the park and seeing friends, you know, on a porch. So to sort of fill us up, give us a little bit of what you think we might be moving towards over the next several months or even next several year or so.
Sure. There's so much to respond to in that kind of series of statements. So let me.
I wanted to make it very easy for you. Very straightforward and easy.
Thank you.
No-brainer kind of questions.
Yeah. Thanks, Michael, for that. So let me just jump in with a few things that I think relate to many of the topics that you raised. And so the first one is this will be with us until we all get really serious about wearing masks all the time in all the places that we go, except with the people that we are closest to in our own households. And that includes riding in cars with people, that includes any indoor space, and any outdoor space where you'll be closer than 6 feet to people. And some of those might be unnecessary masking, right? Like some people will say, do I really need to wear a mask if I'm, you know, walking in a place where I might encounter a group of people? It's unlikely I'll get within 6 feet. It's probably a quick pass. Maybe it's unnecessary in that moment, but maybe it's not. Maybe you are going to encounter someone in that moment that is positive but asymptomatic. And it's only when we all embrace this as something that we're all willing to do all of the time that we begin to see the kind of community control that we need to really shut it down. Essentially, and I think this came up on the last Q&A that we did, we're all holding out for a vaccine right now. We're all really, really interested in getting a vaccine. But we have something right now, masking, that works almost as well as a vaccine if everybody would do it. It's got no other side effects. It doesn't have any safety issues associated with it. It's just present right now in your, you know, rag bag or in your old handkerchiefs. Or you could buy a nice looking mask if you want it to be more stylish. But right now you can have something that if everybody did it, it would be as good as a vaccine or very close. The WHO is saying that they will approve a vaccine that's at least 50% effective. We would like it to be much higher. Their targets are more like 70% effective. But masking, if everybody did it, is better than that. And so I think if we could have a bit of a community shift around the value of masking and really look at what the disadvantages are, which I would argue as an epidemiologist are not that many. It's inconvenient, but there aren't very many disadvantages to masking. And really try to see it as a very low risk preventive intervention that has a lot of benefit. That would be a very helpful transition. So I guess another thing that I want to add to that is that there's been a lot of discussion in Bexley, in Ohio, in the world about indoor masking versus outdoor masking. And so just to share a little bit of the epidemiology about indoor spaces versus outdoor spaces, because I think that relates to Dr. Birx's comment and also to the comments about masking broadly. We really, really don't see a lot of transmission of coronavirus in well-ventilated outdoor spaces. That's probably because it's a respiratory virus and it's transmitted generally through large respiratory droplets, and those tend to dissipate very quickly outside or spread in a way that makes them non-infectious to other people to encounter them. And in indoor spaces, we really have much less ability to control those kinds of droplets. And also there's some growing evidence that there's some aerosol transmission that occurs indoor, and that is very much less likely to happen outdoor. So the indoor versus outdoor space on the epidemiology is a really important distinction. And I think we probably haven't done as good a job as epidemiologists in really emphasizing that for people, because there's lots of ways that people can control their own risk of exposure by moving almost everything that they do outside and wearing a mask.
So that's really interesting information and actually helpful for us. And that thought that masks are actually more helpful than a vaccine is a little bit of a groundbreaking type of thought. Not that it's a new thought necessarily, but if we are waiting for a vaccine, we again almost sort of have that now. Because if we can get that R naught significantly below one, this thing should go away, of course. So Beth, I'm going to direct the next question to you. And in a really practical sort of boots on the ground type of fashion, you know, you and I have gone to restaurants and eaten outside. We've eaten on that little thing on Drexel at Giuseppe's. And but even with that type of thing where no one is within 6 feet of you, occasionally there are things that happen. For example, the wait person gets closer, or another person maybe at work or at a grocery store gets a little bit closer to you. How specifically should we be dealing with that type of interaction when someone is close? We don't want to be rude or uncomfortable. And we probably have amplified the anti-mask type of crowd a little bit more than it needs to be. Probably most people are pretty good with wearing masks, but give us some advice to folks that are watching what to do when you find yourself in a little bit of an unsafe situation.
Well, there's a lot of media now around people getting their femurs broken in Walmart because they tried to get someone to wear a mask. I mean, that actually really happened. And so I think that is amplified. And I think most people will take, and I'm getting better at this, especially in my workplace, to say, hey, listen, just back up a little. I'm going to grab my mask, like if I'm in my private room and someone comes in. And I think that we all have this feeling that that's rude. But I think if you say it with a smile on your face and just say, hey, listen, would you mind for safety's sake just pulling that mask on? Or I say to this to patients all day, every day, hey, listen, why don't you lift that up above your nose and pinch it? That'll keep it on. And I've had to say that multiple times, and I've had no one get offended by that. So I think that there is a general idea of everybody wanting to do the right thing, but there's been so many mixed messages that sometimes if you just say firmly with a smile on your face, hey, do you mind backing up a little? Do you mind if we put that mask up over your nose? And I know it's different in social settings like a store or a 7-Eleven, rather than a doctor's office. So it is hard. And I think that there's a lot of polarizing parts to this mass debate that has been really damaging to this 85-90% that Abby mentions. I think somehow we've missed the boat with this idea of a community effort. And hopefully the narrative on that's gonna change.
You know, it's very interesting. I was reading in the New York Times today about 1918, and there were a lot of folks back then who were anti-maskers also. Oh, excuse me. And, you know, it's amazing that someone wouldn't want to contribute to the community by decreasing spread, because everyone realizes, in fact, we were up in northern Michigan and they had signs on the street that said, you know, wear a mask so our business can stay open. I mean, it does seem like an ideal that all of us as a national community would want to happen. So, Joe, as the, Franklin County is sort of, we're not really under the auspices of Franklin County, of course, but a lot of stuff that happens in Franklin County impacts what we have here in Bexley. Give us some sort of thought on that. Today I saw that the R naught, in other words, the infectivity of each person to transmit it to others, is actually below one now, is 0.9. Now, whether that's true or not, I got it on some app as an alert, you know, so maybe that's not actually the case. But with some of the measures that have been put in Franklin County, is that something that we can expect to see that would improve? And then the next thing would be, as far as implications for businesses and maybe concerts and bars, that type of stuff, where is Franklin County looking down the road with that in several months in the future?
Yeah, that's a great question. So first of all, thank you for inviting me to be a part of this conversation. It's real pleasure to be here this evening with all of you. And maybe, you know, on this concept of wearing masks, I think we need to acknowledge the city of Bexley for their leadership on that particular issue. You know, it was the city of Bexley who required it first, and then other cities followed, and then the county followed, and now the state obviously has done so as well. So kudos to the city of Bexley for its leadership in sort of defining that conversation and help to inform that conversation. You know, I have been really, pleased, for lack of a better word, and how many, when I go out into the community, how many masks I do see. And I think we're at a point now where our community has really accepted the fact that if we want to continue to go to restaurants, if we want to continue to go to work, if we want to continue to do some of the things that we enjoy doing, that's just going to be part of our life for the foreseeable future. And so there's various campaigns and various different ways of you know, sort of motivating and inspiring people to wear their mask, you know, whether it's their self-motivation or the collective good. But it's been really inspiring to see so many initiatives and so many thought leaders in the community to remind everyone why it is that we wear a mask. It's again, it started off about, it's not about me, it's about you, but now it is about all of us. And so that's been a really important shift, and I'm very thankful about kind of where we are as a community. And I think that there is absolutely, you know, we have to recognize that we've now been kind of, it's been now 3 or 4 weeks since we've all had to have required now wearing our face covering. And so we're starting to see our cases starting to decline a little bit. So our daily new case counts are starting to, over the last week to 2 weeks, starting to go down a little bit. So that's very encouraging. And we can absolutely attribute that to the fact that we have so many of our residents wearing their face covering. So where we go from here, I think you know, what we've been thinking about lately is, you know, that now that we're starting to see a little bit of encouraging news on that front, now is the time to really, you know, sort of lean in. You know, now is the time to say, okay, we want to capture these gains and we want to really double down on them and really sustain them. You know, over the last 5 months, we've been doing is playing catch up, because that's just the nature of how this pandemic has gone. And that's how everyone has sort of just tried to handle it. But the fact now is we're at a place where we have some policies that are in place that are going to help us maybe start to catch up a little bit and maybe get to a point where some of our other states that around the country have been able to achieve. So I'm optimistic about kind of where we're headed. And I'm, you know, from the county standpoint, working with the city of Bexley and other communities across Franklin County, I think we're going to continue to, you know, with that collaboration, that partnership, hopefully see additional gains. And we really want to see those over time. We don't want, you know, 2 weeks up, 2 weeks down. We want to see more of a sustained decline over time. And so I'm hopeful that because of some of the decisions and the leadership that's been put forward, that we're going to be able to do that.
Well, Joe, thanks so much for calling out our great mayor, you know, Ben Kessler, who did, you know, work with city council and others to get that mask recommendation here in Bexley and, you know, rule up front. So fantastic to hear about that. I have a couple of follow-up questions for you. I was just going to make sure that folks that are listening know that you can start submitting some questions about 7:30 or so, and we'll try to stick around and answer all those questions. We're scheduled till 8, but, you know, certainly could go a little bit longer if we need to. But Joe, just a couple of quick follow-ups for you. We are at a level 3 alert. Is that right now in Franklin County?
We are at a level 3 or that red level for Franklin.
Okay. Yes. Yeah. And are we on the high end of the level 3 or the closer to 4 or like closer to 2 there?
I'd say if I had to pick, we're probably closer to 2. Okay. The reason that we're still 3 is because of our high incidence of cases that we're seeing. So once those start to come down, as we talked about, we probably are on our way to potentially going to a level 2 or an orange.
Okay. And as far as the level, like, how do we find out the Franklin County? Is there like some website that sort of displays that pretty easily for us?
There is. So on the state's coronavirus website, which is coronavirus.ohio.gov, there is a link, and I can put it maybe in the chat feature here. Maybe we can share it. There's a link where you can go to the Ohio Public Health Advisory System, and then you can see Franklin County, and it'll show you the indicators for each county and why it is that those indicators led to the designation for that particular level.
Okay, that's awesome.
We have a link on our website as well for that.
Oh, good. Okay. Awesome. Thanks. Well, we'll obviously have more for each other here coming up in a second. So Roger Freeman, I know you've been very patiently like waiting for questions, and I thought I'd really hit you with probably the thing that's really puzzled me the most of all of these, with you and your background of allergy and immunology in pediatrics. I mean, that has to be the biggest hot button issue right now, is how infective are kids? We know that they carry a lot of virus, but the question is, are they spreaders, and how much of spreaders are they? So can you just sort of speak to that a little bit? Rare for kids to get ill, but at this point, I think probably a lot of people are just thinking, how much can they transmit to adults and people at risk?
Yeah, it's a great question, and one that we keep learning more and more about literally every day. It's been complex. It's been early on in the epidemic, from China especially, it looked like children didn't get the disease. And we were kind of comforted by that for a while. And then we discovered that maybe we just weren't getting good information. And children clearly can get this disease, no question about it. Most of them tolerate it very well, comparatively. We have lots of theories about why that is, because they get lots of other coronaviruses, because of maybe immunizations, maybe because their bodies, their immune system are different. It's not that they're more protected, it's actually that they kind of respond a little less well, in that they have less what we call cytokine storm and less autoimmune phenomenon. So that's been an encouraging part. And then there was the theory that maybe they didn't spread it much. And I think most of us have been suspicious about that, especially pediatrics. We know how kids put their hands in their noses, and we know they put it to parents, and you know, us parents and grandparents get everything kids have. So I suspect that we keep finding more and more information. And as you alluded, they clearly are carriers of the virus. And the question is, will they spread it as much as other viruses? There's no reason to think they won't. And I think as we discover more and more, it's going to be an issue. And you and I talked a bit before, you know, there's the camp in Georgia where 700 kids got this disease. Now, it's interesting, that camp had a lot of singing involved. And we know that there are, you know, spreading events, and singing is one of those. And so that may have been one of the reasons why that camp, whereas a whole bunch of other camps didn't seem to get as much. And again, you know, can children wear masks to prevent things? Absolutely. In fact, I find that's one of been the most interesting thing, where parents are worried, can their 8-year-old wear a mask, or their 7-year-old? And actually, in our office, and I take care of literally thousands of children, children of 4 or 5 years of age wear a mask better than their parents do. They get used to it very quickly. They don't have any problems with it. And again, I think at whatever age we decide, whether it's, you know, kindergarten or third grade or fifth grade, whatever age we want kids to wear a mask, they'll be able to do it very well. And I think, again, until we get a vaccine, that's still going to be our best approach. And I think, again, we can prevent them from spreading.
You guys hear me right now?
Yeah, now we can.
Okay. It's funny when you say that. You know, Beth was talking also about like the patients who have kind of a thing, or like on the chin, you know, and I found the exact same thing. I'm almost like every room I walk into, and then like the second time I walk in, they're like grabbing their mask real quick and pulling it up, you know. So parents, you know, adults don't really seem to mind too much, but kids absolutely don't mind. I mean, they have it on, and it's just sort of there, and it's not really a big deal at all. So
they adapt.
I'm gonna guess
well
if it's like a 1-year-old.
Yeah.
So they're pretty good.
I want to say one thing. We're pretty clear in pediatrics. You shouldn't wear masks under 2. That's from the AAP. So under 2, it may be somewhat harmful breathing. After 2, no problem at all. So that's a real
okay. Point. Yeah. That's a good thing to think about. And so, Joe, I was going to sort of go back to things with you, just as far as in Franklin County, you know, testing still seems to be an issue. There's a lot of different places that do testing, but it's not as bad here as it is in some places. I've heard stories around the country of like, you know, 10, 14 days until you get a result, but still it might be several days. Where are we at with, do we have enough reagents, enough swabs? Like, you know, until we can get that the number down enough, like you were saying a second ago, to be able to do contact tracing, you know, it's going to be difficult to really get it under control. Where are we at right now in Franklin County with testing?
Well, I think where we are in Franklin County is kind of where a lot of our state is right now, you know, we're doing a lot of testing, but we want to do more. So right now we're doing probably about 2,500 tests per day. And that's data that we receive from our hospitals and community health centers. It's not inclusive of all the tests that our local pharmacies are starting to do as well. And so, as you mentioned, though, you know, we are seeing this spectrum of you know, how many days it takes for those tests to be returned. In some cases, it's within 24 hours, which is great. In other cases, unfortunately, we're seeing, you know, lags of 4, 5, 7 days, which at that point, you know, from a public health standpoint, it puts us way behind the eight ball in terms of any kind of, you know, meaningful contact tracing. So, you know, for us, testing has been a priority, like every health department. We've been looking at opportunities to increase testing capacity here in Franklin County. I want to give a recognition to Columbus Public Health, who has worked with their hospital, our adult hospital systems, to expand testing at Columbus Public Health. So when you couple that with our community health centers, our four hospital systems, and then our private, pharmacies and so forth, I think we're in an okay place, but we're actually looking for more community-based testing opportunities. You may have all seen last week, the National Guard was in Reynoldsburg for one of the pop-up clinic opportunities that they do with local partners. That actually, I think the number I heard was 460 people received a test in a matter of 5 hours. And so that's incredible, particularly for that part of the county, which has had much higher incidence of cases. So we're looking for more of those kinds of opportunities, looking at more partnership opportunities to bring more testing available to particularly those who are most at risk, most vulnerable, and need to have timely testing. And I think obviously that's the key, is that timely testing. So we are working as a county with the state health department to with our kind of 8 or 9 other peer counties across the state, so the Hamiltons, Cuyahogas, Lucas counties, and so forth, kind of putting together a state local testing strategy so that we can kind of align what we're doing here locally with what the state's trying to accomplish, whether that's community-based testing like the pop-up clinics, long-term care testing through the National Guard for our long-term care facilities, et cetera. So it's a comprehensive kind of, we're trying to take a comprehensive approach to testing and look for more sustained opportunities. But the number that we have now is certainly, it's okay, but we want to continue to find more opportunities and more timely opportunities for testing.
Yeah, and so that's fantastic to know, because I would think that as obviously there's an economic incentive for folks to get testing going, hopefully it will continue to get faster and more widely available. And so, yeah, getting us to know where these outbreaks are. And it sort of speaks a little bit to what Roger and Beth were talking about too, is, you know, at camp when you're singing, there are certainly higher risk situations. I mean, you know, I'm no epidemiologist. I mean, Abby, right? You know, but I'm just saying, like, walking by someone in a grocery store, probably not a huge amount of risk if that person has it. On the other hand, standing next to them singing in a choir, obviously for an hour or so, that'd be an incredibly high risk type of thing. So it's just minimizing our own exposure, then obviously we minimize the chance that we would contract it and expose others. And I wanted to also say, if people can take a peek in the chat area, Joe has put up the link where we can see what the Franklin County level, alert level is. So we're all looking for number 2, Joe. That's what we're going for. It could be like 2.99, but just get it in the 2s somewhere. That's what we really wanted to see have happen. So Ben, we talked at the last time that we discussed stuff about stuff that Bexley is doing as a community for some of our more at-risk residents. And I don't mean at risk of, you know, because they're singing in a choir at church necessarily, but folks who are maybe elderly or just have more needs or less ability to sort of get out and fend for themselves. Fill us in a little bit on what we are doing for others within our own community here in Bexley.
Well, thanks, Dr. Mike. first off, I want to give a big shout out to DARN, which is our local developmental assets resource network. DARN has been doing a fantastic job of connecting families in need with the resources that they need, especially food resources over the past several months. And then we've also spun up a volunteer coordinator. Elizabeth Ellman has been working with the city for for months now and helping to connect a volunteer network. We have a volunteer network now. I think around 200 residents have signed up to help people who have needs. Actually, we have a surplus of volunteers and a shortage of needs. And I think we're more and more trying to, you know, let people know that this resource is out there. Whether it's folks need help getting some groceries picked up or even a little odd jobs around the house. There are lots of residents in our community right now who are understandably and suitably staying at home, staying safe, and we have safe protocols in place to help connect those volunteers to people who have needs. So if anybody, you know, is looking for an extra help, Elizabeth Ellman, and I'll put her email in the chat, is available, and we have information on our website about that as well.
And so the website is just bexley.org?
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked me that. Bexley.org/coronavirus. And okay. There we maintain some Bexley specific stats and updates about the latest recommendations and also how to connect to our volunteer network.
Thanks, that's fantastic. And it's great to know what we're doing in Bexley. And you know, it was interesting as we were talking about that last time, Beth, who works at Equitas with a community that's not a Bexley community, but a Columbus community, a neighboring community that has a tremendous amount of need. A lot of your patients do, Beth. You had sort of brought up the fact that, you know, here we are, not all of us, but many folks in Bexley have this ability. And interestingly, you know, Ben, how you say we have more volunteers than we have need for recipients, or at least, you know, requests for their expertise and their help. But, you know, Beth, you brought up the fact that we could do stuff within our community, but also to help other communities too. So just fill us in just a little bit on some of the stuff that you're seeing, again, boots on the ground within your office with the communities that you serve, and maybe some thoughts that you would have on how we as Bexley could reach out to some neighboring communities to help them.
Oh, sure. Also, someone had texted me that I think our chat function is disabled, so that they can't see Joe's link. So I don't know how to fix that, but maybe you do. Anyway, so yeah, I think, we've all read the dire economic predictions for the coming year or two. And I think that we're gonna see more need in our community than we could possibly even imagine at this point. I have lots of patients who have lost employment, who have food needs, and already. And I mean, this has just happened in the last few months and we're coming into the winter. So I think that whatever you are doing locally, which might involve helping with some volunteer needs just down the street, that there's gonna be so much more available to help out with, whether it's monetary donations to the Mid-Ohio Food Bank or time spent packaging, serving, carrying boxes to cars, whatever type of volunteer work you're able to do. And then that trickles down to the kids. A lot of kids are gonna be in need of, whether you like to tutor or mentor, or, I mean, the opportunities are endless. I think that what we might see some of, a sliver of here in Bexley, the wider community need is gonna be much vaster. And I think we all need to be thinking more broadly across the city. But in my clinic, I'm seeing a lot of need for referrals to food banks and assistance already.
So that's obviously something so important for all of us to, you know, care for ourselves as well as care for others who have less ability to do that. So thanks for sharing that. I wanted to give a couple questions that some of the folks have answered, and someone had mentioned that the chat function has been disabled. Somehow they aren't able to see the chat, but we're gonna try to get that enabled, but the question and answer part is certainly live. I'm gonna just sort of go through some of these. There's a bunch of questions here. Abby, I'm gonna answer like Michael Scott from The Office says, like give the answer as a fourth grader, and then you can actually give the more expertise answer. Someone asks, can you explain what the R not is? It's a guard and a little O. And my sort of, again, explaining it and my understanding as a fourth grader would be that is the level of infectivity each person has. So if each person that has COVID gives it to two people, then you can imagine then it goes to four and to eight and to 16, et cetera. It goes very quickly. If that number is above one, it keeps spreading and the number of people keep increasing. If it's less than one, then it goes below that. So that's the R naught. And it's really now reported, I've seen it more recently just as the R is what people are, is how it seems to be reported. So Abby, what did I get right and what did I get wrong?
So you got it mostly right. So the distinction between what you said, well, you combined two concepts that are often combined, and so I can just straighten them out quickly. So R naught is in the absence of any preventive intervention or a vaccine or anything done in order to control disease, the R naught is the average number of cases that any infected person will go on to transmit to, right? And the R naught for coronavirus for COVID-19 seems to be around somewhere between 2 and 3. Some studies have it at 2.5, closer to 3, some are less. That's in the absence of any kind of mitigation effort. What we're trying to do, and R naught is not a changeable number. That's a fixed biological phenomenon, R naught is. It's a characteristic of the disease. But R, the reproduction number, is the one that we're trying to control. And that's the one we're trying to drop below one, so that in an actual effect, the number of cases that each infected person goes on to transmit to becomes less than one. And if it continues to stay less than one and further lower than one is better than just barely less than one, we can kind of snuff out these little burning clusters that are leading to more cases.
Okay, all right, awesome. So here's another question, and there's multiple questions on this, so I just sort of wanted to sort of put that out. Obviously, the country has a lot of COVID, but if you look at the Ohio map, and Joe, you could, if you wanted to speak to it more, but it's so interesting that there's certain clusters where it's like really red, and then other places where it's that sort of lighter color, the yellow or light yellow. It's I might not have the colors exactly right, but the fact is that it really is more present in some places, and it's probably not that surprising because there's a greater density of population in those places. But I have a couple questions here. First of all, and this could be for anybody really, Joe or Ben, but how do we get reporting for which Bexley residents have it? And Ben and I know you and I spoke about that a little bit earlier today. So that's one thing of what we have in Bexley. And another person did a calculation here, and they said they show that in the 43209 zip code, there's 92 cases. So Joe, I don't know if you like have every single day the exact number of cases and every single zip codes at the top of your head, but they said that that's 0.0034% of the population. So, let's just bring it home here and hit this question head on. How do we know how many cases are in Bexley? And I'm guessing because the second part of the question with the 0.0034 talked about the schools, there's obviously other issues with the schools beyond the students because there's teachers and food services and custodians and other people that are in the schools too. But how do we get an idea specifically in our neighborhood how prevalent COVID is?
Mr. Mayor, do you want to go first?
Well, I'm happy to, but I get the numbers from you, Joe. So here in Bexley, we report our statistics. They're provided to us from Franklin County Public Health. They have been so kind from early on in giving us that information. So Joe, I'm going to pass that baton on to you.
Okay. So on our website, you can go on to our website, ifcph.org, and click on the COVID page, and you will see our daily EPI report. That EPI report gives you a whole host of information, general demographics for all of our cases, including our EPI curve that we update every day, and a breakdown by zip code of those cases. So I didn't see that particular question, but what I can tell you is, this virus, we of course know about all the cases that are reported, all the laboratory confirmed cases, we know about those. What we don't know about are all the other cases that we know are out there. We have a lot of individuals who are asymptomatic, who are potentially spreading this virus, which is why we need universal masking. And so we have to assume that when we are out, that we could come across anyone in the community who could be COVID positive. And so that statistic that you cite, though mathematically likely true, the fact is that we have active community transmission happening in our across Franklin County. We have positivity rates of the last couple of weeks above 10%, and our case counts continue to be, even though they're starting to decline, as a county, continue to be a significant concern. That prompted a visit from Dr. Birx from the White House Coronavirus Task Force a few weeks ago. We know that Columbus and Franklin County have had a higher burden of this disease than across the state. We have the highest number of deaths. We have the highest number of cases. Interestingly enough, we don't have the highest number of hospitalizations. And that's because our leading demographic for number of cases is between 20 and 29. And so from a morbidity standpoint, we've not had that same burden. So, you know, for me, you know, I think what's important is that we have that message out there is that, yes, we're of course tracking those number of cases by zip code. We want to continue to make data available to the public. We really believed in making sure in a responsible, appropriate way that we're putting out information so that our community does understand the burden that this disease is taking on our community at the most granular level that is appropriate.
Yeah, so here's a question for Roger. And the question is, when you look at those cases at that camp in Georgia, someone caught you saying the word disease when in fact it, I guess, and I might be reading into their question a little bit, is they had COVID present, but they didn't necessarily have disease. And we all know with things like, you know, group A beta hemolytic strep, right? You can be colonized with it, but not actually be infected with it. And so speak a little bit, Roger, to the fact that there were so many people at this camp that came down positive, well, but did that actually cause illness?
We know with COVID, it's of course a very interesting disease in which you can be asymptomatic. So having no symptoms doesn't mean you don't have the disease. It means you've got the disease with no symptoms. And you clearly can spread the disease. And that's very important. And much more important, I think, what people have just now beginning to understand, we've now got some very interesting data, studies, and information about people who had very little to no symptoms, yet ended up having very significant abnormalities. In other words, we've done CT scans of their chest and lungs and shown significant fibrosis. They've got heart issues in some people who were asymptomatic, yet found myocarditis episode information, and very scary to lots of us, has been some of the CNS neurologic things that people have had, having strokes later on and actually having abnormal CAT scans of the brain and MRIs of the brain. So again, there's a lot we don't know. But what we do know is that if you're positive for COVID, you have that virus in you. And although it may not always show symptoms, it may very well cause long-term consequences or can cause long-term consequences. And very clearly, you can spread that disease.
So I'm going to sort of give a little bit of a follow-up question on top of that. These kids that had that at the camp in Georgia, and I don't know the exact numbers there, but I'm guessing that probably we would have heard about it if anybody would have died from the camp, that type of thing.
Right.
How do we differentiate all those kids being at the camp together with all of that COVID from then when all those kids come home to different types of homes, multi-generational, at-risk homes? It's a whole different story once you get there.
Mike, you're so right. There's no question that one of the biggest concerns we all have about schools and children getting COVID, especially if it's asymptomatic, hopefully the kids will do great. That's what we all hope for. No one wants any child to be ill acutely or chronically. But we do know that if their parents get it, they're more likely to have more problems. And clearly, grandparents getting it are the highest risk of having fatalities, of being in the intensive care units and stuff like that. And so that's why we want to try to, again, this whole thing with masks and people were against them for a long time, I mean, it was kind of silly. It's like, you know, wear a mask to protect grandma. That's a simple message that we in Bexley started to give out, and I think it's important everywhere that we wear a mask to protect all of us, but in particular, you want to protect the most at-risk group, and those are the elderly, people with other diseases, and the like.
Yeah, and I have to say, the first time that I wore a mask, I was like in my office, and it was like 15 minutes, I'm about ready to like tear my like face off. And,
sure.
And now, honestly, it's like I put the mask on, and granted, it's a little bit of a, you know, more cotton and it's a little soft or whatever. It's so not a big deal to wear that mask. I mean,
I'm gonna add to it. You know, as you know, there's been a lot of recent information, and a lot of the health systems have now mandated that the physicians and healthcare workers also
really
wear
eyewear. This.
And
yeah.
Eyewear. And I've told people now that as much as I don't like my mask, I hate my goggles worse. But mm-hmm. But you get used to it, and you work with it, and you live with it. And that's what we do.
Yeah, exactly. So I want to just bring something to Abby here, and there's a question about Sweden. I know that you are not only an epidemiologist with expertise in America, but every country of the world. So so I'm just going to read the question that they asked, but I'll give you maybe, if you could just try to do like 60 seconds or less, just so we can get to some of these other questions here. And you might have read the question also, but just for folks who haven't, explain the epi curve in Sweden, a country with a population similar to Ohio and a large city similar size to Columbus. Case numbers, deaths, hospitalization, or hospital utilization has run its course down in near zero without mask shutdowns, school closures, or anything else. I'm not sure that would be what I would have taken away from the news of Sweden, because I thought it actually didn't turn out quite as good for them as they had hoped. But can you speak to that? Do you have knowledge of their experience?
Yeah, so there? I'll just jump in with a couple of things. So the first thing is that lots of people were watching that Sweden experiment. Nobody, many countries were kind of curious to see what would happen. And what you just described is correct. They started with a extremely kind of low interventionist approach in terms of public health mandates, did not match their kind of peer countries around them, and pivoted to have much more public health intervention when their cases started to increase. It is true that they have lower death rates and fewer hospitalizations. And to that, I would say, look at the average health status of a person in Sweden, look at the annual income, look at universal health coverage, look at the average BMI, look at comorbidities, look at the proportion of people with diabetes and heart disease. Those numbers are all drastically different in Sweden than they are in the United States, and certainly in the most vulnerable communities in the United States. And so it's just not possible to have a population comparison between Sweden and the United States in terms of looking at kind of broad health indicators. But Michael, I wanna jump in on a couple of other questions that are on here that I see people have raised, and I wanna take a moment to clarify some things if I can do that, if that's all right.
Yeah, fantastic, yeah.
Super, so one
of the- Extend your 60 seconds.
Okay, great. So one of the questions that people ask, I'm just trying to scroll to it to make sure I can see exactly what was raised, was about if wearing masks are as effective as a vaccine, would I recommend that people can start back to in-person safely? So a really important part of prevention interventions, including masking, is that they stack together. No one of these things is going to solve 100% of the problem, including the actual pharmacological vaccine when we have one, right? We have to embrace these things in combination. And so what would happen if we all wore a mask right now is that over time, these little clusters of people who are infected and infecting their contacts, who are going on to infect their contacts, we would interrupt those transmission chains. The people who are infected would go on to infect fewer people. They would have fewer contacts. Those people would infect fewer people, and so forth. It's not that different, actually, from when you get a vaccine, and it takes a month or 6 weeks for you to begin to have an immune response that actually protects you. The first day you get it, you're not protected. You're still at risk of acquiring disease, and if you're already positive at that moment, you're still at risk of transmitting it. But over time, you begin to have a reduced viral load if you're already infected, or you begin to have reduced likelihood of transmission, or sorry, of acquisition going forward. And it's only when lots of people have a vaccine and everybody has sort of gradually amplifying protection that you begin to have population level control. And the mask would work similarly to my mind, which is that if we all began to do it now in 4 weeks, in 6 weeks, we would have burned out those little clusters such that population community transmission would not disappear, but it would be happening at much lower rates. And in that way, it is similar to a vaccine, but it isn't like start tomorrow. Another question that's on here is about riding in the car with people. And I do think that this is something that has not been very effectively discussed by CDC and by others. The inside of the car is like being inside a room with somebody, or kind of worse because it's really small. So absolutely you should treat it like being in a small enclosed space with somebody else. And whenever possible, you should ride with all of the windows open. But the idea that masking might be optional in a car is, to my mind, the opposite of what the epidemiology supports. Masking in a car is even more important. Sorry, just to answer a final question that I see here, and we can talk about others, but someone correctly said, like, it seems like there's a lot of information about what's risky and what's not risky. And if we're wearing masks, can we change what's the risk calculation? You know, what does it mean to fly? What does it mean to go into certain kinds of spaces? If we're all wearing masks, do those things become safer? And the answer to that is yes, if we're all wearing masks, those things all become a bit safer. But until we're past this case surge that Joe was talking about earlier, we have to avoid closed spaces, meaning with poor ventilation. We have to avoid crowded places because we're just gonna breathe on and get breathed on by more people. And we have to avoid close conversations or close singing. We have to incorporate those three ideas about our behavior together with the mask. It all works together. Actually, I do have, one other question here I want to answer, which is that somebody asked about ventilation. And so just to provide this, they asked, what is the safest way to improve ventilation in a room? And we've probably all seen some of these nice graphics that show, like, on a plane, in a call center, how was the air moving? How was the air conditioner set up for who got infected and who didn't? So the best way to control ventilation is have a fan blowing outside the room, taking the air that's in the room and blowing it out of the room, not circulating it around the room and not blowing air from the outside in. Having air from the outside going in isn't bad. It dilutes kind of what's in the room, but it also forces any infected air, any aerosols in that air, kind of blowing madly around that space instead of getting it out of that space. So a very effective way to improve ventilation is really just with a fan moving stuff. You know, you could use a filter, you can use an air conditioner, you can use other things, but really just a fan blowing out of the room into the outside is a very quick and easy way to do that.
Fantastic. For some reason, my very last part of what you said sort of dropped out, but I like that idea. And we actually have an emergency department negative airflow room, so the air is being sucked out of the room. Again, that doesn't protect us completely. But when I think of everything, and Beth, I'd be interested in sort of your thoughts on this too, but, you know, and the other folks, physicians on the call, it's like anything that we do as a physician, or really even just in our lives, you always think about what is the possible risk and what's the possible gain. So yeah, you could get in a car accident on the way to the grocery store, but you sort of need to eat too. So it's a risk you're willing to trade off. Risk of being an accident, but the very incredible gain of the fact that you get to eat dinner that night, right? But in the same way, you know, the hassle with wearing a mask, and it's really astounding, those numbers. I mean, even the, you know, the head of the CDC was saying, like, 4 to 6 weeks, if every single person wore a mask, like 100% of the time when they're within 6 feet of others or whatever, that we really would have this thing under such better control. And if we can get to that point, then what we could do is start that contact tracing, start the actual quarantine of people who have illness. I mean, it's something that we need to get to this point until we can move further. And because our world is so intermingled, that though cases are low in Bexley, at least diagnosed cases confirmed by testing, still there, I'm sure, are others who have it that are not manifesting illness or haven't been tested. And then in addition to that, there's other people that are in our community that aren't actual Bexley residents, but are, you know, our friends and are working here and different sort of things. And we have to be cognizant of the risk to them also. So those are some really good points. And you know, the questions, a lot of these questions are fantastic questions, because it really asks where we are at and some of the specifics for us and our community. One thing, and Roger, I'm gonna sort of bring this up to you a little bit, and I've heard some of this data also, is that when healthcare workers, and unfortunately, so many have been around the world affected and have died. And I just want to also bring up the point of like, it's not just mortality, but it's also that potential morbidity. And there's a very real possibility that in 10 or 20 years, we're going to be seeing people with COVID lung who have some of that irreversible lung scarring that maybe they're fine in their 30s and 40s, but when you get into your 60s and 70s, might have home oxygen, that type of thing. So this is something that you can't only look at just people who have died or been hospitalized, because some of this stuff we're not even going to know about for an extended period of time in the future. But they ask a question about, once universal masking started happening in the hospitals, the number of healthcare workers infected went down to, at least what this question said, was down to zero. I've heard some of those same statistics for different hospitals in New York City and emergency departments. Can you speak to that as far as where we're at now compared with the beginning part of the epidemic, and as far as still a risk that you would have, even if you're doing those masking and goggling things that you talked about?
No, that's a great question, Mike. Clearly, as we all know, early in the epidemic and the pandemic all over the world, we had a tremendous shortage of protective garments and protective masks and stuff, and people had to make do with what they did. And it didn't work so well, obviously. We had lots and lots of healthcare providers getting infected. And now we have way, way less. We do have, we don't have enough perfectly, but we have a lot of protective gear, and consequently, way fewer of our healthcare workers getting infected. That's been a real positive. And again, we've had very few cases that we know of people wearing their stuff appropriately getting into trouble. So that's encouraging for all of us physicians and nurses and first responders and stuff. I think that's a real important point. As far as the other point about, more importantly, is, again, this is a new disease. It's a novel disease, and it's causing a different disease than we've seen. We really haven't seen many viruses that have caused a vasculitis like this. And that's what's been so confusing and so difficult to get our hands around at times. Because, again, early on, a lot of the deaths were due to strokes in kids, people who were intubated and stuff. And now we know how to prevent that. So we're saving a lot of lives that we weren't before. We're doing a darn good job. The people in the ER, you folks, and people in hospitalists and ICUs have done a much better job. But these people who are surviving are having consequences. They're going home on oxygen. They're starting out with oxygen. I've taken care of a bunch of patients who have come into me as an allergist and immunologist and pulmonologist who are now short of breath and having problems and having abnormal lung capacities compared to what they had before. And again, you'll hear this story again and again. I was an athlete, I was competitive, I was running, doing, I can't do that right now. I'm having symptoms. And again, people are complaining about memory issues and cognition and stuff. And again, we see this in other viruses, but this has been very unique. And I think it's, the deaths are the tip of a terrible iceberg, but I think the consequences for lots of people, and if it does happen in children, then we're going to have a lot of problems later on. I tell my families, don't go to COVID parties. That's a bad idea. And do your best to avoid COVID. If you get it, I don't want you to panic. Most of you are going to do okay. That's important. You don't have to live in fear. And I agree with, Abby and I have been agreement completely about masks, but I do have great hope for the vaccine too. And I think the vaccine is going to be our ultimate answer. And we're going to hopefully get one or two or three vaccines that will be effective and will change the course of this disease and get us all back to a new normal where most everything is normal, but we don't shake hands ever again.
Well, yeah. And honestly, I'd be totally fine with that. I never really enjoyed shaking hands in the first place. The elbow bump seems much cooler to me anyway. So, this has been a really fantastic discussion. So many questions, and obviously questions, some are unanswerable questions, and we're all really taking our best guess based on the available data. And that data changes, and there have been points made of some statements people made early in the pandemic, and even some of the care that's being given in the emergency department with early intubation or fluids, we're doing the exact opposite now with patients. And so as we get more data, as we get more information, we learn more about this, But the fact is that we absolutely need to get this thing stamped out as much as possible, get it down to a level where we can start doing contact tracing, be responsible to obviously others in our community, and not only by wearing masks, but also as Beth had talked about and others too, you know, reaching out to people in our own community and other communities that are in need. So it's 8 o'clock, and you know, we should do this again. Certainly there's a lot of stuff still to talk about, but Jen and Ben, thank you so much for putting this together. And thanks so much to all the panelists for your expertise and, you know, taking the time on, you know, your evening here to share some of this knowledge that you have with us in the Beckley community and Columbus community. So thanks so much to everyone again. And we'll sign off now. We'll talk to you all next time.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much. Thanks to everybody. Thanks. Good night.